Right. Evening all. We are looking at criminal law now. Where we've come from and where we're going to. We're coming towards the end of talking about FSA regulation. The cases towards the end of conduct of business we're going to pick up again in relation to contract, which is our next topic. But now we're sort of building a bridge between conduct of business, regulation of formation of agreements and so on and so forth by the FSA, and so-called market abuse. Market abuse straddles the criminal offences of insider dealing and market manipulation, which we'll move into towards the end of today, but in particular in detail as per the timetable tomorrow and next Thursday. And the non-criminal jurisdiction, nominally, of the Financial Services Authority to regulate market abuse. Market abuse is primarily concerned with the misuse of inside information, in inverted commas, in securities markets. I'll define all these terms. Well, I started early, sorry. So we're thinking about markets on which shares are traded, bonds are traded, securitised derivatives and all those kind of things, the so-called securities markets, and trying to prevent inside information, which in headline terms means information which isn't generally known to the market, being misused or abused by certain swines, shysters, whatever you want to call them. Allied to that, we'll also look at what's known as market manipulation, when people try to make things like securities seem more or less valuable than they probably are, if it wasn't for the efforts of those people to make them seem more or less valuable. So we're concerned with all those kinds of distorting elements. As I say, there are two jurisdictions here, really. This has been part of the criminal law for a while, insider dealing, particularly since 1993. And we've added to that bit of the criminal law, so-called market manipulation, that we'll talk about in detail in a bit. But, headline effect. The criminal justice system is just thought to be too slow, too cumbersome, and basically unable to stop this kind of thing happening. Its deterrent effect doesn't seem to outweigh the deterrent effect of making lots and lots of money. So instead, the idea was to give the Financial Services Authority the power to regulate and investigate and to prosecute these kinds of market abuse. So in other words, if the FSA is close to the action, let them try and stop it happening. Well, let them investigate it if it is thought to be happening, rather than waiting for prosecutions to rumble on years after the event. There have been very, very, very few prosecutions under the criminal law for insider dealing and related offences in the UK. It just hasn't happened. Hence the need for the FSA to get involved. So that's our kind of backdrop, that's our big picture as to what's going on. Some weeks, this crap just writes itself. Insider trading crackdown, front of the FT from the 17th of October 2009. But to be fair, this is in the US. Billionaire investor and executives charged. First use of wiretaps to gather evidence. Anyone watch The Wire on TV? Brilliant stuff. If you haven't, do. There's a theory I rather like, the DVD box sets, then you casual sex. Instead of forming short-term relationships with human beings, you form short-term relationships with DVD box sets. But you fall into line with people's patterns of talking and behaviour and everything else. And then when you're bored of them, you just drop them. Like proper casual relationships. Here everyone's listening now. So here we have billionaire investor Raj Rajaratnam, president and former executive of Bear Stearns, IBM, Intel and McKinsey. McKinsey, the management consultants. were charged yesterday in an alleged insider trading scheme that US prosecutors call the biggest ever involving hedge funds. There's lots of interesting stuff inside about all the stuff people were saying on the phone. One of the alleged plotters telephoned one of the other alleged plotters and said, "Don't talk about this on the phone." Why are you bringing them again? The whole stuff is hilarious. They all think they're in films. It's great. In a possible sign of escalating federal efforts to uncover white-collar crime, Preet Bharara, US attorney in Manhattan, said the case marked the first time court-authorized wiretaps, a traditional tool of investigators pursuing mob bosses and drug kingpins, like Marlowe Stanfield, had been used in a significant insider trading case. So this, it seems, internationally is really stepping up. Giving all these powers to the FSA has marked an escalation of this in the UK, but they're really going for it in the US. So using wiretaps and all that kind of fun stuff as well. The charges should be a wake-up call for every hedge fund manager and every Wall Street trader and every executive who's even thinking about insider trading. So this is definitely one to watch. Definitely one to watch. This will rumble on through our course gloriously. Nothing like a high-profile prosecution. People in uniforms and all that. It's funny how the press knew to be there, isn't it? It's amazing that there were photographers just happened to be there when the guy was brought out. You'd think someone had wronged someone in advance. Okay. So that's going to be a backdrop. It's this kind of stuff that we're talking about. We're talking about very rich and otherwise very professional people dealing in securities in ways that they shouldn't, basically. So let's fill in our background. We're really then looking at four things. We're going to think about our background principles and the purpose of all of this law. That's going to be our first thing. We're then going to look at the Market Abuse Directive, or MAD, if you like, which gives us the high-level principles in the Lamb for Lucy way for all of the FSA regulation. That's what we'll spend a lot of our time on today, going through exactly what market abuse and insider information and all these kind of things are. And then the criminal offence of insider dealing, which is also predicated on EC directives. And that we probably won't get to till tomorrow, and we'll tidy that up next week. Insider dealing lends itself to problem answering and examination, questioning, and all those sorts of lovely things. It did when I did company law last year, for example. So there's already podcasts and stuff on the company law bit of my site, and I'll migrate them across the finance bit at the minute. And then fourthly, we'll look at money laundering, which is our own dear Peter Aldrich's pet subject, and he has a book called Money Laundering Law. Jolly good. And so your seminar on this will focus on problems on insider dealing and money laundering primarily. So let's just think, why do we regulate market abuse? What are our principles? What's our purpose? What are we trying to do? There's an interesting line, I think, between what is criminal law seeking to achieve and what is financial regulation seeking to achieve. If you were thinking about writing about financial regulation, how does it work, how might it work better, and all those kind of things, one thing you could do is to compare and contrast the criminal law and financial regulation. Thus far, I've tended to talk about private law and how that interacts with financial regulation, but there's this side of the fence too. There are probably three different objectives, I would suggest, behind the various regulatory and particularly the criminal offences in this area. We've got a first objective, which is simply to punish in the ordinary way one would expect from criminal law, just like the law on murder, just like the law on theft. They're to punish miscreants once they've done these sorts of things. Now, it's often said as well that we hope the criminal law will have a deterrent effect. You know, you won't stab whoever it is because you'll fear being locked up or whatever. But if you think about it, and I think it's useful to think about it for our purposes presently, the criminal justice system, criminal law, is reactive. You have committed a crime and then the criminal justice system wields into action slowly. Yes. So there's all of that stuff that you'll have studied when you study criminal law. There are lots of criminal offences in the financial services context, and I think this is the second objective, which are concerns with supporting the Financial Services Authority in its work. What do I mean by that? When we look in detail, for example, at securities regulation, we'll see that Section 85 of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, FSMA, Section 85 of FSMA doesn't say you must have a prospectus before you offer securities to the public. What it says is, if you don't have a prospectus, you commit a criminal offence. Which, I mean, it's an odd thing, there isn't actually a positive statement anywhere in the Act that says you must have a prospectus. That's all left to the FSA handbook. What the Act often does is to say, if you don't do X and Y in compliance with what the FSA requires, you commit an offence. So this happens a lot through FSMA. We're using criminal offences to ensure compliance. It's as though it's the ultimate stick. So that seems to me to be a very important way in which we do this kind of stuff. Yeah? So people are only going to obey the Financial Services Authority if we say otherwise you'll go to prison. The third objective in relation specifically to insider dealing, market abuse and securities markets is the prevention of abuse but also the maintenance of market integrity. This word integrity gets thrown around a lot. We've mentioned the word integrity when we looked at the PRIM, Principles for Businesses source book in the FSA handbook. Remember? That first rule that all authorised firms must comply with, but they must act with integrity. And we barely spoke at all. I defined that in terms of honesty and soundness of moral principle and all that kind of stuff. There's another sense in which integrity gets used by regulators, and that's the integrity of the markets. The markets must be able to function. How do markets function? Well, as we've seen in the last couple of years, markets function when people have confidence in them. Because here's the underlying deal for the whole of securities and investment policy. The reason we do this on a US-UK model is that we realised, and the Americans realised it a long, long time ago, that you can get a lot more money raised for businesses in your jurisdiction if you don't just rely on banks lending, but you also rely on ordinary members of the public investing their little all as well. So it's a very important source of funding to get the likes of you and I investing in shares. Primarily, that's what ordinary civilians will invest in. More and more these days, people investing in other things, but they tend to do that through mutual funds, what we tend to call unit trusts and similar products in the UK. You're only going to get people to risk their little all, yeah? Their life savings or a portion of their salary or whatever it may be, if they feel that the markets are safe, if they feel that they're sound, if they feel that they are fair. And that's the integrity that the policymakers have got in mind when they're concerned with criminalising and outlawing things like insider dealing we'll talk about in a while. Because no one's going to invest in a marketplace if it's fixed. My old dad, bless him, was always wanting to invest in shares back in the day. And when I was working in financial institutions myself, to say, what's the point? There's so much that they know that you don't. There is so much rumour that they know weeks before you find out about it, if ever you do. You know, you really are investing in a fixed gain in the first place. Well, that's exactly the impression that no one wants you to get about financial markets. They want the idea that no one is able to make money on the basis of information that only they know. And so one of the things we're going to think about is there's an odd line there between someone who's clever and knows things and has worked things out for themselves, and someone that knows about information that they shouldn't be using or misusing. Okay? And so we're going to cruise where exactly is that line, where is something being clever, and where is something that's simply abusive. Okay? So this maintenance of integrity is important. The expression that gets used in the European regulatory framework a lot is the need to maintain deep liquid pools of capital. I love that expression. If you're having a bad day, just imagine a deep liquid pool of anything. Yeah? It's a wonderfully lyrical phrase, a deep liquid pool of capital, meaning there must be enormous amounts of capital out there that firms can raise by issuing shares or issuing bonds or whatever it may be. This is very much a UK and US model, it's always perceived as being such. In continental Europe, it was far more the case not that they didn't have securities markets, but it's far more likely that far more of undertakings funding would come from banks, would come from ordinary lending. In Germany, for example, I've never mentioned this before, banks like Westdeutsche Lenders Bank and the Lenders Bank, the regional banks, would be far more closely in touch with small and medium-sized enterprises, and even quite large enterprises, and they tended to provide them with debt and forge a very close relationship with them. What we've got instead with the securities market model is quite a distant investor base. The likes of you and I invest either directly through our pension funds, maybe we put money into a mutual fund like a unit trust, but we're not involved with talking to management on a day-to-day basis. We're not finding out about their needs. We don't care. What we want is money, primarily. Whereas if you're a bank that has a very close relationship with, for example, a German industrial company, you're more likely to know a lot more about their business and have a lot more to do with the human beings involved. So it's a very different model there. But once we've decided we want to access this different capital, we have all these problems of making sure the marketplaces are going to be attractive. So integrity is something we're going to keep thinking about, which is one of the policies that underpins the Market Abuse Directive and the Insider Dealing Directive we'll talk about later on. Just a few ideas about this line between regulation and criminal justice. We talked a bit last week about the difference between substantive law and regulation, but I tended to focus on private law again. It seems to me that what happens is a regulator enforces, whereas criminal justice reacts. I'm having a sound bitey kind of a day today. A regulator enforces, by which I mean the regulator, one hopes, is going to be watching the marketplace all the time. Hour by hour, minute by minute, transaction by transaction. Sitting in its lonely castle, the regulator will be there watching it all happen. You know, you get the idea. They're going to be looking for odd market movements. For example, during the financial crisis, HBOS's shares crashed and then bounced back up again, as did Barclays. Particularly with HBOS, there was thought to be a concerted attempt by lots of people to talk that share price down, spreading rumours deliberately that HBOS was in real trouble, so the share price would plummet, so that you could buy shares when they were low, knowing that when everyone realised the rumours weren't true, that share price would come back again and you could sell all the shares off. Now, if we're looking at the criminal justice system in that kind of arena, we're going to have to wait for the serious fraud office or, you know, the police, somebody to investigate, take a long time for prosecutions to come on. This is going to happen, if it happens at all, many years after the event. The market isn't reacting to that. Whereas the FSA can step in immediately and require information and conduct investigations and those kind of things. So a regulator is able to interfere in something that's going on in the marketplace. If you like, in this sense, a bit like a policeman being on the spot before the murder actually happens. Apparently it's one of those policemen that intervenes. Not one of them that thinks, oh, I'll let them kill each other and then arrest the living ones left at the end. That's the usual police approach to riots and that kind of stuff. Let them kick the hell out of each other and arrest them when they're all tired. You can see the sense in it. So criminal justice reacts. It reacts after the event. Yes, it's all investigations after the crime has happened. And so we're not able to stop things happening in the marketplace using the criminal justice system. It's got a different way of behaving, a different way of acting, fairly obviously, really. So on the upside, that makes the FSA look like it's more interventionist, like it's going to achieve more. At the other end of the spectrum, the regulator will also consult. And this, I would suggest, is very different from what the criminal justice system does. Because the criminal justice system doesn't consult, it imposes judgment, penalty, and so forth. As we've talked about before, the FSA will issue consultation papers, will ask for comments from, you know, anybody, but primarily they're looking for market participants and their professional advisors and so on and so on, to give them their views on how the regulations work or don't work, or are likely to work or not work. Criminal justice system doesn't do that. So if you want something that's going to stand against market power, stand against the market doing whatever the market wants, the criminal justice system, on one view, does that much better, in that it doesn't listen It simply says, this is a criminal offence, you have committed it, here's the penalty. The other approach might be to say, well, maybe we need to understand what it is that markets are doing, and not necessarily just criminalise for the sake of it, but actually to work out what is abuse and what isn't. What is legitimate market innovation? What's legitimate profit making? So that's why the FSA consults, because it wants to construct appropriate rules. And remember, the FSA also has that obligation in FSMA to ensure that it maintains the UK's competitive edge. It's got to look to the needs of the UK economy and not just regulate in the abstract. So depending on your view, you might think that's a positive thing or a negative thing. Looking at the financial crisis, we might think, well, the FSA should have got more involved. And actually, it was far too close to the marketplace. It was far too keen to seem to be everyone's friend. Jolly good. So we'll come back to more of that when we do the market crisis later on. But I think that's an important difference with the criminal law. The word that's generally used about regulation and financial institutions' reaction to regulation is compliance. Yeah, financial institutions comply. Which I said before is an interesting etymology of working with. Com suggesting with. Whereas in relation to the criminal law, we generally talk about obedience, I think. Obedience or disobedience. Which seems to me is a different word. Okay, it's a different word. But yes. Okay, so I think that gives us some background and some structure in which you could discuss all this if you wanted to write about it. Let's think about market abuse. On your handout, we're on page 34, chapter 4. Even though it's number 2, it seems to be headed 1.1 Market Abuse Directive. That's probably because I can't count, apparently. The Market Abuse Directive gives us the policy underpinning this whole area of law. As I said before, looking down the handout, 1.1.1, the preservation of market integrity, and the need to create an integrated and efficient financial market. So this is what the Market Abuse Directive is trying to do. Integrated in the sense of a single European market, all that fun stuff. And also an efficient financial market, which I think is meant we're not going to have distortions created by some people knowing about inside information and misusing it. Or people driving markets up and down deliberately. Another policy under the Market Abuse Directive is the need to have these deep liquid pools of capital, this efficient capital market that's going to create economic growth and job creation in the EU. So that was another idea. That if we have more capital available to businesses in the EU via securities markets and everything else, as well as ordinary bank lending and all that stuff, that will fuel growth because there'll be more money available for businesses to raise through share issues, bond issues, whatever it may be, and then apply in their businesses. That will mean more growth, that will mean more jobs, and it'll all be lovely. There won't be a financial crash, it will all be fine. Bless. So what's our problem with market abuse? Next bullet point. Market abuse harms the integrity of financial markets and public confidence in securities and derivatives. So we need to maintain this integrity, as we mentioned before, and we need to maintain public confidence in securities and derivatives. Could public confidence in derivatives be any lower than it is now, probably? But that's the plan. If we look as though we're acting against market abuse, then we'll encourage people to invest in the markets because it's all okay. And we want a deep pool of liquid capital, and that in turn needs the confidence of a concomitant pool of investors. Yeah? We need ordinary punters to be comfortable that this isn't rigged. So we're concerned with two things. We're concerned with inside information being misused, and we're concerned with market manipulation. So what do those two things mean? Off the handout. Inside information is information of a precise nature, so it's not just general rumours, oh, I think telecoms are in trouble, you know. It's information of a precise nature which has not been made public, relating directly or indirectly to one or more issuers of financial instruments, or to one or more financial instruments in which, if it were made public, would be likely to have a significant effect on the prices of those financial instruments, or on the price of related derivative financial instruments. What does all that mean? This is in relation now to the FSA regulation of these markets. Okay? So in what circumstances can the FSA intervene? The information has got to be of a precise nature, not defined. It must not have been made public. Okay? And that's left deliberately vague. We'll talk about this a bit later on. But that would include not having been dispersed across a recognised information system. Not having been spread, for example, across Reuters or across Bloomberg, one of those news systems that are used in financial markets. Nearly all traders have one of their screens on their desk. So it's not being made public in that sense. It's not being made public by a company, for example, making a formal announcement, for example, to the stock exchange, that they think their profits will be down next quarter or whatever it may be. Now there's a grey area there about rumours. What happens when rumours become spread so far? What happens when something's all over the internet, quote unquote? You know, is that public or not? It's certainly not official. And it must relate directly or indirectly to one or more issues. So it might be news about a particular company. In this sense, it's going to be a particular company that will be the issuer. Yes, thank you. Myelin makes people so annoyed, doesn't it? Governments can issue bonds, for example, but for our purposes we're thinking primarily about corporate securities. So it might relate to one or more companies. So it might just be a very specific rumour, it might be a rumour in relation to a number of different entities, whether directly by name or indirectly. So if we're talking about, you know, anyone that has a particular market or particular factory in a particular jurisdiction, that might necessarily relate indirectly to a particular company, if not naming them. And our test is, if it was made public, i.e. if everybody knew about it, would it have a quite significant effect on the prices of those financial instruments? When we come to the criminal law context, we'll see that the test is one of whether the information is price sensitive. And I would suggest this is just really a rewording of that concept. Would it have a significant effect on those prices? So if everyone did know, would the price go up or down? Would it have a significant effect? Significance will depend, again, on the market. When I used to do a lot of stuff in relation to Central Europe, long time ago, early 1990s after the Berlin Wall came down, when the Hungarian stock market opened, it had something like, I've got the number 11 in my head, 11 different companies quoted on the stock exchange, and that was it. Bless. You know, just starting, a couple of big tractor manufacturers and whatever else. And very, very few organisations. Now, if you had a rumour about 1 out of 11, let's assume I've got that number right, if you had information about 1 out of 11, even a comparatively small movement in that particular stock would have a huge effect on the total proportion of the stock market, if you think about it. Yeah? Whereas much larger stock exchanges with thousands of companies quoted on them, you know, will have much less of an effect. So when we're looking at the London Stock Exchange, something that seems in percentage terms to be quite small might be taken to have a significant effect in that context. But all of that very much depends. You know, when you look at, oh my God, we've had a shocking day on the stock exchange today, it went down 2%. You might think, oh, 2%. But that's taken as being something significant and shocking, whatever else. So it all depends on the context. And these things have been left deliberately vague, I would suggest, to work out what we think a significant effect is in that particular sense. We might look, for example, at what's the standard deviation in that particular security on a normal trading day. If it's a very well-known, very well-established manufacturing company that's, you know, strumming along quite happily as it always has done, then we might think, well, you know, a comparatively small change there might be significant for that particular stock, given it doesn't ordinarily move very much. Whereas there are other stocks that will be much more volatile. New companies are far more likely to be much more volatile. Technology sectors tend to be much more volatile. So it depends. And so what we're really asking you to do in thinking about these cases is to think, well, what are the possible arguments? Again, we don't have much case law, so we're just going to think, what does significant mean in this particular context? What might be the parameters in which we discuss and decide that? If there was a definition, I'd tell you. Or the price of related derivative financial instruments, what does that mean? We may be talking here about the financial instruments themselves, so things like shares. Yeah, remember shares? This is where you acquire a share in a company as a shareholder, meaning you have a right, if you have an ordinary share, to vote in that company's annual general meeting and other general meetings. You have a right to receive a dividend and all those other funny things. We may have bonds, which if you remember was a security, which you get in return for effectively making a loan to that company. The company pays you interest regularly, and at the end of the loan period, you get your capital sum back again. Great thing about securities and bonds is that they can be sold on the market, so you can profit simply by their price going up or down. Yeah. Then we talked about them being all kinds of in-between things like warrants and convertibles and whatever else. The fun thing about derivatives markets was, in this security sense, they added an entirely new dimension to securities dealing. Because you didn't need to buy and sell the share itself to make a profit off it. You didn't need to buy and sell the bond, or whatever other security you might be talking about. You might simply take an option. There's one example we gave of a derivative a couple of weeks ago, whereby, for example, you're able to buy the option if it reaches a given price. Or you're entitled to be paid the amount of profit you would have received if you had actually bought and sold the option. Now, the reason why lots of different jurisdictions, and Germany used to be particularly astute about this back in the day, many jurisdictions are very concerned about derivatives, is that at one remove, off exchanges, this isn't being done in public, it's not being done on an exchange, this is, can just be done between traders, between two banks, sitting on their trading floors, no one can find out exactly what it is they're doing. They might simply decide to speculate on, or if you prefer, bet on, whether or not a particular share price will go up or down. Now, that will have an effect amongst other financial institutions once they realise that people are speculating in their way. Once other financial institutions realise that X and Y bank are both betting, or both selling products which seem to suggest they think the price will fall, the likelihood in the marketplace is everyone thinks this is going to go down. To quote George Bush, this sucker could go down. And therefore, the derivative is likely to force the share price down without there being anything visible on the exchange to justify why that price might have fallen. It's simply rumour going on in the background. So it's not just these days that you're using your inside information to buy and sell the share itself or to buy and sell the bond. It might be that off exchange, on a trading floor somewhere, you've entered into a contract which says, I have a right to buy this from you at one price and sell it back to you at a different price, and you have to pay me the profit, the difference between those two things. The option enables you to bet in that way. And so that's why we have this reference to related derivative financial instruments, which is a new thing in this Market Abuse Directive. Because when we had the old Investment Services Directive, of course, derivatives in their current form didn't really exist, and the markets didn't exist in the way they do now. So we're always thinking about what are the other ways people could speculate now off these exchanges. And that's the fun of derivatives. It creates a whole new virtual world, just like the Matrix. Anyone out there on Reeves? So that's inside information, broadly put. Market manipulation. Sounds like fun. 1.1.3. Market manipulation involves... Bless you. You're welcome. Transactions or orders to trade, which give or are likely to give false or misleading signals as to the supply of, demand for, or price of financial instruments. I think that's just a key expression, that one in and of itself. Transactions or orders to trade. So you don't actually have to have bought and sold, it might just be an order. For example, buying an option. Which give or are likely to give. So it doesn't even have to have happened, it's just that it's likely to give. False or misleading signals. For example, and Citibank have got into a lot of trouble for doing a lot of this in Japan on various securities markets. You might just decide that you have a large enough presence in a particular market, either because you own a lot of the stuff or your trading desk is just well known and well understood and its views tend to be believed in the market, that if you decide to start putting it about that you think a particular stock is going to go down. And maybe you start putting it out that you've bought these deals. You might go around various different brokers and say, we think this stock price is going to fall. So what we want to do is to fix a price at which you will buy this thing off us, what's known as shorting a stock. You enter into contracts which say, the current market price, for example, is 102. We want a contract with you where you will promise you will buy from us at 100. What you're saying is you think the price is going to fall below 100. You think it's going to fall from 102 down to at least 99. And you put it back in the marketplace, you think it's going to fall much further. That will start a ripple and a rumour out there. And if you do this in a coordinated way, if you do this with other people, mates of yours at other institutions, you really can force a stock to fall really quite fast. And then you just watch it go. Once that sentiment started, everyone will start saying, entering into the same deal. And then you just wait, and you wait, and you wait. Like the end of Trading Places, which Trading Places? If you want to know about how this stuff works in marketplace, watch the last reel of Trading Places, one of my favourite films. But it's really good at this. You just let the price fall and fall and fall. You wait till you think it's hit the bottom, and you just start buying up in huge numbers. And everyone thinks, oh my god, people are buying into this. It must be going up again. And the whole thing whizzes back up. Okay? So this is what we're talking about. Market manipulation, when you encourage a price down or you encourage a price up artificially. Okay. So it's transactions or orders to trades which give or are likely to give false or misleading signals as to the supply of, demand for, or price of financial instruments. Or which secure by a person or persons acting in collaboration. So I was talking about, you might have people across different firms, or even the same institution, just in different jurisdictions, which secure by a person or persons acting in collaboration the price of one or several financial instruments at an abnormal or artificial level. And it's this artificiality that's important. It's hitting a level that it wouldn't otherwise hit. There's a nice idea from John Maynard Keynes, the economist, in the treatise on, is it the treatise on management, the general theory, oh God, I can't remember, it's page 152, whichever one it is, where he says, what you're doing in securities markets, the reason why people do this, the reason why traders are lulled into this kind of thing, is because they are not necessarily investing in a sensible, objective way. If you're investing in a sensible, objective way, you sit back and think, is this business any good? Is its management any good? Will it make me money in the long term if I just sit still? This is the way Warren Buffett invests. Sound company, sound product, sound management. I'll invest in the long term. And you become a billionaire if you hang in, if you're Warren Buffett. What most market traders do, they're trying to make money now, now, now. You want to make a profit today. You want to make a profit this month. You want to make sure that across that year you certainly have made a profit, because that's when your bonus is paid. Yeah? So what you're doing, according to John Maynard Keynes, is you're not making guesses on what you think of a share necessarily. What you're doing in a lot of these high-pressure trading environments is trying to second-guess what will everyone else like. You're not. It's like betting on who's going to win X Factor or something. I don't know what X Factor, but I'm guessing that. If you're going to bet on who's going to win X Factor, it's not about whom you like most. You're trying to second guess whom will the general public like most if you're trying to pick the winner and put a bet on it. Yeah. Same with stock markets. You're trying to second guess what everyone else is going to do. So by definition, you're trying to work out what will the herd bet on. And so as soon as something starts to go down, you're not thinking, is this actually a good company? If I hang in there, will this all be all right in a few days' time or in a month's time or in a year's time? What you're thinking is, everyone's going to sell, so I need to sell too. Because this price will go down, I need to sell now while I can lock in some profit, and then I've made a profit today, or I can buy stuff back tomorrow. So everyone in markets is reacting to what everyone else is doing. It's like herds of wildebeest or whatever else, looking at each other and thinking, oh my god, running lion! And they're off. Yeah. Although actually, when you watch nature programs, when you see the wildebeest running off, you also see one daft one standing by the edge of the watering hole, just looking about itself, you know, as the lions rush past. There's always one wildebeest that seems to be entirely above it all. I suspect that's the Warren Buffett of the wildebeest herd, thinking, I'm investing in this watering hole for the long term. Anyway, sorry. God knows what that was about. So that's what we're thinking about with those kind of transactions. Again, that's why markets move in that particular way. It's the herd mentality. You're not necessarily thinking rationally. You're thinking, what will the herd do? And We're also looking at B, transactions or orders to trade which employ fictitious devices. So anything that's fictitious. And we'll look at how the FSA does this in a bit. And C, the dissemination of information through the media. We'll come back to that in a second. So those are the general principles of the Market Abuse Directive, and we'll see that B and C are pretty much implemented in much more useful detail by FSMA itself. So the scope of the market abuse provisions, it's section 118 and the following sections of FSMA that implement the Market Abuse Directive. There is a market abuse rule book known as MAR1, M-A-R-1, which is the FSA's market abuse source book in the FSA handbook. But we're going to focus on the very useful definitions of market abuse that appear in FSMA. So this is 1.2 on your handout, 1.2.1, definition of market abuse. Section 118, which has been amended to give it effect to MAD, provides that for the purposes of this act, market abuse bestie is behaviour, whether by one person alone or by two or more persons jointly or in concert, which A, occurs in relation to qualifying investments admitted to trading on a prescribed market. So we're talking about, for our purposes, securities traded on a proper regulated market, like the London Stock Exchange. That would be our example. Remember, post-MIFID, we're trying to cover all potential markets, not just formal exchanges. We're trying to cover everything. Two, qualifying investments in respect of which a request for admission to trading has been made. So, for example, your shares don't have to be quoted on the stock exchange yet. It might be that you've just applied, bless you, for them to be quoted on the stock exchange. Three, in the case of subsection 2 or 3, behaviour, investments, which are related investments in relation to such qualifying investments, so anything linked to them, derivatives and so forth again, and B, that falls within any one or more of the types of behaviour set out in subsection 2 to 8, and that's what we're going to look at now. Subsection 2, which is the first type of market abuse, is a reference to insider dealing. The first type of behaviour is where an insider deals or attempts to deal in a qualifying investment or related investment on the basis of inside information relating to the investment in question, which is what we'll pick apart in a lot of detail when we look at the offence of insider dealing tomorrow. This will include lots of things. Some of the examples the FSA gives of what kind of thing is it concerned with. So we have an insider, which we're going to define in detail tomorrow, primarily meaning someone who is employed by the issuer of these securities or who's acting in some professional capacity in relation to that issuer. That's what makes you an insider. Look at that in detail tomorrow. Who deals or attempts to deal in a qualified investment, a security, on the basis of inside information. So the inside information must be the thing which prompts you to deal. I know this price is going to go up tomorrow because I found out this information because I'm their solicitor. Yeah, that's going to be the thing that prompts you to deal. Well, that and greed, obviously. Greed we take as red in these markets. So what are the sorts of things the FSA thinks about? Well, things like lots of market acronyms, some of these are fun. Front-running is one, where you try to deal buying or selling the securities before the announcement is made, known as front-running. Okay. You do all your dealing before the stuff is made public, fairly straightforwardly. A lot of abuse takes place in relation to takeovers. You know, when a takeover is in the offing, this generally forces share prices up, because it's assumed there is therefore a market. People will want to buy those shares. You need to buy the shares in the company to take it over. You need to have a majority of the shares. So by definition, you expect the price to go up. So one of the things the FSA talks about is if in relation to a takeover or close to a takeover, or even just the long process of a takeover taking place. And I discuss all that stuff in chapter 42 in the book, if anyone's interested. If you deal in securities for a purely economic exposure, meaning you're not buying the shares because you want to hold the shares and participate in the company, you're acquiring a merely economic exposure, you want to make a short-term gain, then that will constitute market abuse. Also in relation to takeovers, if you're a professional advising someone involved in a takeover, and you deal on your own account, that would be taken to be market abuse. So, for example, you're a solicitor advising someone who's about to be taken over, or who wants to do the taking over, and you think, oh, I know this thing, brilliant, I'll buy some shares for myself. That will constitute market abuse. As we'll see, the offence of insider dealing is even broader than that, and it will involve you tipping off your relatives, your friends, anybody to act on your behalf, or on their own personal behalf. So we'll see the offence is much broader than that. We'll get to that tomorrow. The second type of market abuse is improper disclosure, top of page 36. The second is where an insider discloses inside information to another person, otherwise than in the proper course of the exercise of his employment, profession, or duties. And the FSA gives two examples of this. One, disclosure of inside information by the director of an issuer to another in a social context. And two, selective briefing of analysts by directors or issuers of others who are persons discharging managerial responsibilities. So, in the conduct of your employment, profession, or duties, if in a social context, this is just an example the FSA gives in the market abuse rulebook. You're at a party, you're at a barbecue, and you say to someone, do you know, I'd invest in Wizo PLC about you, they're really going up. That's something that's known in the jargon as tipping off. And that will constitute market abuse in itself. So it's not just that you have to do these things yourself, it's enough that you need someone else to do it. They don't necessarily have to have a link to you, it's enough that you just let this drop. One of the things we'll talk about with the criminal offence is whether or not that third party commits an offence too, and usually, yes, they will. Also, the selective briefing of analysts. Financial institutions employ analysts whose role is to inform traders, inform the marketplace about what they think about your company and its prospects because of your financial performance, and so on and so forth. What the large companies do is they spend a lot of time talking to analysts to explain what's going on with their business, what's going on with their financial statistics and everything else. So if you start briefing analysts and letting them know that things are going to happen, that in itself can constitute market abuse. You can't be involved in selective briefing, picking on two or three and letting them know about something and not everyone else. The aim is that the whole market comes to know at the same time, so no one gets an advantage. Okay. What else is there? Misuse of information. The third is where the behaviour is based on information which is not generally available to those using the market, but which, if available to a regular user of the market, would be, or would likely to be, regarded by him as relevant in deciding the terms on which transactions and qualifying investments should be affected. So it's a kind of regular user test. Is this something which isn't information that's generally known, but if it was generally known, would have an impact on a regular user? And B, as well, is likely to be regarded by a regular user of the market as a failure on the part of the person concerned to observe the standard of behaviour reasonably expected of a person in his position in relation to the market. So not only is it information that the reasonable user would find important, but also what would a reasonable user think about your not having disclosed it publicly? Now, I often get, I've got an email overnight asking me to act as a witness or give advice or something, it's not entirely clear, in one of these claims, where always what I'm asked to do is to give an opinion on what the standard market practice is. Everyone assumes, because I'm a professor of finance law, I will spend my time logging what people do in the marketplace, and I'll maintain graphs, presumably, of what it is that people do in the market and what standard market practice is and isn't. And they're always shocked when I say, A, no, I don't. B, go away. And C, what is standard market practice? Do you know? Do you measure it? Is there any way of proving this? There isn't. Very, very difficult to establish what standard market practice is. So this is kind of an equivalent of commercially reasonable conduct we see in some commercial law context. This is an example of a reasonable user test and all that kind of stuff. But it's very difficult to prove, I would suggest, in the abstract, in financial markets. It's very difficult to prove what financial market practice is in any particular circumstance. Particularly emerging markets, we're talking about innovation and whizzing new things like derivatives. How can there be a standard market practice yet when the product is brand new? And so all these things are very, very difficult to prove. I don't mean to have a down on the legislators because it's very, very difficult to work out what rule would you have instead. But I'm an academic, I stand here moaning, pretending I'm clever than everybody else. That's what we do.
Sad, isn't it, really?
The fourth head is where the behaviour consists of affecting transactions or orders to trade otherwise than for legitimate reasons. So your defence here, your excuse, is that you have legitimate reasons. And in conformity with accepted market practices on the relevant market, again assuming there are such, which A, give or are likely to give a false or misleading impression as to the supply of or demand for, or as to the price of, one or more qualifying investments, or B, secure the price of one or more such investments at an abnormal or artificial level. So similar to things we looked at in the directive. This false or misleading impression and an abnormal or artificial level of price. There's something in the market known as a wash trade. Hygiene, very important. Which is a trade that has no commercial purpose. It's not because someone actually wants to own the securities or not, for some other commercial reason. A wash trade is where, often between entities that are controlled by the same person ultimately, you have, for example, subsidiary A sells securities to subsidiary B, or what appears to be a profit. B then sells on to subsidiary C. Subsidiary C will then sell back to subsidiary A. On paper, it looks like there's been lots of dealing then in those securities. You fix the price to make it look like one or two of those people made a profit, but in the end, you make sure it all evens out at zero across those various subsidiary companies. If you do that a few hundred times in a hurry, it makes it look like the market's gone crazy. It makes it look like everyone wants these shares. And so suddenly, the idea is, people will start to come into the market. You'll be creating a false or misleading impression by dealing in those securities. And this is as old as time. You go back to 1720, and one of my favourite bits of English history, the South Sea Bubble. There was a company created called the South Sea Company by a man called John Blunt. I'm sure I must have mentioned this before. There's a very good book on this by Michael Balon called A Very English Deceit. I rather like that title. We have a new king, as with all the Georges, you know, brought in from Germany. I almost said flown in, but that's inaccurate in 1720. He had no friends in the English court. He spoke German, didn't speak English. He had a country that had a huge national debt. And, you know, he was a king. He wanted to wage war. That's what kings did at the time. So he needed money. But this national debt was enormous, and he owed huge amounts of money then to the individuals who had lent money and effectively got bonds, is what we call them today, from the government in return for their loans. Blunt had the idea, I'll set up this company which will go and trade in the South Seas, what we now call South America, because everyone believed that there was gold lying around on the ground in what's now Brazil. And all you had to do was just get a boat and sail out there, maybe stick a few sheepskins on there, and you trade with the natives, and they'd give you all their gold because they'd be daft, and you'd come back. Yeah, that was the basic idea. So what he did was, he said to everyone that was owed money by the government, I will give you a share in the South Sea Company if you give me some of your bonds in return. Now, why on earth would people do this? Well, he was clever. He gave money to well-placed people in society to buy shares. And he then said to everyone else, to all the coffee houses in London, which is where shares were traded on before there was a proper exchange in the 18th century, they're buying the shares, why don't you? And so other people thought, oh, if they're buying, this is members of the royal family, there's cabinet ministers and their families buying all this kind of stuff. So suddenly this market exploded. The same thing was happening in France at the same time, something called the Mississippi Company. Now, the South Sea Company had no business. It was a complete scam. But what Blunt was doing very successfully was every time people invested money in the South Sea Company, he would use that money to bribe people to buy shares, to make loans to people to buy shares, and he made a market. Yes, this is no. He was market manipulation. He was encouraging people to think these things were valuable, and the price rocketed upwards. It's the same thing that's going on now. Nothing is new under the sun that hasn't been going on for hundreds of years, particularly if it involves crime, stealing, and greed. Talking of crime, stealing, and greed, why don't you go and have an evening and do some of those three things? And we'll pick up with that tomorrow.